B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, November 30th, 2017. Over at the Trump White House, they're scheming about a game of musical chairs. And when the music stops, Rexxon Tillerson will be headed back to Texas. Now, this is not a big surprise that Trump wants to sack Tillerson. They have not been on the same page, clearly. And I don't know how anybody as Secretary of State can get on the same page with this idiot who will tweet and muck up things that a diplomat is attempting to deal with. And one of the things that is interesting about this is when a figure who I disrespect is dismissed from a cabinet post, I always cringe and think, well, he or she was pretty bad. But chances are the replacement will be even worse. And through an authorized leak from the White House, which could be case number 29 for the Justice Department to crack down on leakers, we are learning that the rotation has already pretty well been put in place. So Tillerson out, replaced by Mike Pompeo, who is a protege of the Koch brothers and has been for the last 10 months serving as the director of the CIA. So Pompeo moves from CIA to state. Now, that's a bad move just on the face of it, all right? I think Pompeo is a dangerous guy. But consider the impression, the perception that is created worldwide, that we move a guy who was running our top spy agency into the top diplomatic post. His credibility, his ability to be trusted, to be able to promote diplomacy over military or covert action by the intelligence community, is going to be deeply compromised. So that's a bad move. And then the official leak from the White House indicates that Pompeo would be replaced at CIA by Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. He's a young guy. He's a veteran of the Iraq War. And he's a hardline Neanderthal conservative. Also cozy with those Koch brothers. Now, all of this would require Senate confirmation for Pompeo to go to state and for Cotton to go to CIA. But we've seen that the Democrats have been unable to stop most of Trump's nominations. There were, I count, two withdrawals, but not a single candidate has been rejected through the confirmation process. And so that's how it appears the new year will begin, year two of the Trump nightmare. Now, it's also interesting that BuzzFeed is reporting that there is a secret plan under consideration by CIA Director Pompeo to outsource, to privatize key operations, including covert actions, intelligence gathering, and propaganda missions, plus rendition, which is the polite word for kidnapping. The idea would be to sign a contract with a private company that's loaded with former spooks. It's called Amyntor Group, A-M-Y-N-T-O-R, and it is based in Whitefish, Montana. Just like that two-person firm that got the big contract to reconstruct a power grid in Puerto Rico. We're told there's absolutely no connection, but Whitefish is such a small town, it's hard to imagine. One proposal presented to U.S. officials would allow individuals affiliated with the company to help capture wanted terrorists on behalf of the United States. International bounty hunters! Now that's the answer. People close to the company are tracking two specific suspects in a Middle Eastern country for possible rendition to the United States. Now, It appears the motivation for all this is that Trump doesn't trust the CIA because it's the source of the Russia hacked the DNC, Russia meddled in the election in favor of Trump. And I don't quite understand how Pompeo, who has straddled the Russiagate issue rather cleverly, I'm not sure how that makes him a candidate for promotion to Secretary of State in the jaundiced eyes of Donnie Trump. But that's what we're being told, and I cringe at the possibilities that lie ahead with these people in critical positions. Late yesterday, I released an interview with Jason Leopold that I promised to listeners a few weeks back during our Facebook Live feed. And I argued with Jason, politely, about the way he wrote a story that was published on November 8th at BuzzFeed profiling Robert Johnston, the consultant at CrowdStrike, hired by the Democratic National Committee to examine their servers and come up with a plan to prevent future hacks. It was Johnston who declared that because of his previous expertise developed around a hack at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that he could easily conclude that Russia was responsible for the DNC hack. And I'm troubled by the way Jason reported this story, and I shared my concerns with him. And I have to say, we had a good exchange. It was difficult at times. And when I played a clip from a phone call that I received during the Facebook Live event a few weeks back from listener Kyle Kyleman, who declared his deep respect for the work that Jason Leopold has done in the past but called this story garbage, that really offended Jason. And I want you to hear this excerpt that begins with the end of the clip from Kyleman's call and Jason Leopold's reaction.
Yeah, this is very concerning. To have somebody who I've considered to be, you know, in the top echelon of trustworthiness suddenly produce essentially garbage.
Well, so there you have it, Jason. That's
my God,
Kyle's
take. You know, Peter, I mean, I don't know how you want me to react to that. Essentially produce garbage. I produced an article on the guy who was at the center of this, okay? Mm-hmm. You can disagree with it. Listeners can disagree with it. Fans and former fans can disagree with it, okay? I explain in the article what happened when he saw it, you know, and what should I have done? Kill my story? He offered, you know, an explanation, and in the context of the Joint Chiefs. So he, you know, explained how he came to figure out or believe that this was, you know, hackers associated with Russia. As I noted when we first started speaking, mm-hmm. This is so highly politically charged with so much, you know, feelings of distrust toward the DNC, you know, and the way in which the DNC has operated. And I think that's totally warranted, by the way. And so I feel that lots of criticism is, you know, in a way sort of, you know, directed at or the feelings, the strong feelings that people have as if I'm trying to defend, you know, what the DNC is saying. There's nothing I can do about that, Peter.
All right,
the only thing I can continue doing is reporting, is trying to find that evidence, and I'm going to continue reporting. And I'm perfectly okay if people, you know, have an opinion of my work or something like this that's garbage. I tend to disagree, and other people disagree. So I understand that some people feel differently about it. But, you know, I always strive to find documentary evidence and to stand that up.
I hope you'll listen to the full interview with Jason Leopold, because despite my own discomfort with, you know, hashing it out with him, you will hear that he defends the larger narrative of Russian involvement. He promises to keep digging to find the missing evidence that causes me to remain a skeptic. I was really distressed at the way he dismissed the theorem advanced by Bill Binney, and he didn't address, for whatever reason, the most critical point that Binney has made, which is when he was at NSA, he designed the systems that allow NSA to track any packet on the internet because they have every switch, every network node wired. And Leopold said, look, the article wasn't about that. He acknowledged that he did ask Johnston about Bill Binney's theorem, but he didn't publish anything about that because he said he just dismissed it. Well, I would expect the CrowdStrike consultant, who is the central source of the claim that Russia hacked the DNC, to dismiss Bill Binney. And so, while I am glad to share the interview with you, it is disappointing to me that a man, Jason Leopold, who has built his career as a journalist on finding the documents that prove where the government has lied or covered up or erred, that he seems willing to trust the intelligence community, despite the lack of public evidence, despite that the entire story is based on leaks and anonymous sources. So I invite your comments after you've heard the interview with Jason Leopold. Now to the tax battle in Washington. It does appear that the Republicans may be able to pass this package, which isn't even finalized. It's amazing. They've begun 20 hours of debate, and they are still tweaking the package behind the scenes. Despite that, John McCain of Arizona has removed himself from the undecided column. He's going to hold his nose and vote for this stinker. And he offered really lame reasons why he would do that to help the middle class. Here's a quote. I believe this legislation, though far from perfect, would enhance American competitiveness, boost the economy, and provide long overdue tax relief for middle class families. And he's got to know that is bullshit. Meanwhile, Susan Collins of Maine is still holding out. She wants to change the provision about deductibility of state and local taxes. That's important to California, I'll tell you that. She also is quizzing about the idea of a trigger that would raise taxes if the targets related to the deficit are exceeded. And this is a real slippery slope. We lost a governor in California, Gray Davis, over a stealth plan that raised the car registration tax without an act of the legislature or the governor. It had been embedded in a recent law that had rolled back the car tax because California had enough money, and it was an irritating tax that people didn't like. And Gray Davis thought he was so clever. When the taxes went up, recall petitions were circulated, and Arnold Schwarzenegger jumped on that bandwagon and took it away from Gray Davis. And his killing the car tax on day one in office, that's Schwarzenegger, led to the budget debacle that put California in the red for years after that, and we finally dug out after Jerry Brown returned to the governorship. So the Republicans are just trying to ram this through. Democrats have no leverage. They can't filibuster. They can't really stop it. They may try to offer a bunch of amendments, which will follow the 20 hours of so-called debate. But it's clear that the Republicans hope to pass this by Friday. And then, as I mentioned before, when it goes to the conference committee, which is all Republicans, even more damage can be done. Trump went to Missouri yesterday for one of those MAGA rallies with his fans. And he promoted the tax plans of the House and Senate. And he said, this is going to cost me a fortune. This is not good for me. And this is just another whopper, a huge lie from Trump. He's good at the big lies. A lot of people believe his bullshit. But it is quite factually true. As Stephen Rosenthal at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center says, Trump will make out like a bandit on all the big items. The removal of the alternative minimum tax, the preferential treatment for carried interest for real estate operators. He'll get a huge windfall on rental, license, and royalty income. And so it goes. We are going to get screwed, royally screwed. Now we turn to the sex offender registry here in the U.S. today as the Me Too wave continues. The Washington Post revealing that the effort to feed it a false story by a woman who claimed she'd been raped and then had an abortion. She claimed she'd had sex with Roy Moore, got pregnant, and then he helped her get an abortion. And the skilled reporters at the Washington Post, I have problems with the Post on a lot of issues, but they did smell the rat and they trapped it. And it all leads back to James O'Keefe, Project Veritas, this 41-year-old woman, Jamie Phillips, who we now know was trying to infiltrate the Washington Post for months before this scheme to pop a false story about Roy Moore came to light just this week. She went to various parties. She hung out at a bar around the corner from the Washington Post facilities where reporters congregate. And once her cover was blown, all kinds of people said, oh, yeah, I ran into that woman, including, get this, Brad Woodhouse, the former communications director for the Democratic National Committee. He rented a basement apartment in his Capitol Hill home to Jamie Phillips. And when he saw the story, he was floored. He said he recognized his former tenant while reading the Post story. I was stunned. It took a little while to sink in, and then it was like, really? Are you kidding me? So I'll run these down quickly for you. Nancy Pelosi, under fire from some of her own party members, has shifted into a demand that John Conyers resign, partly fueled by an appearance of one of her accusers on the Today Show without Matt Lauer. The woman's name is Marion Brown. She's the one who got the settlement from Conyers that led to the issues and the allegations against him. The 88-year-old Conyers is currently hospitalized for stress and exhaustion, but he says he will not resign. Al Franken is facing two additional accusers. The total is now at six. One woman is identified as Stephanie Kemplin, an Ohio Army veteran who encountered Franken on a USO tour in Kuwait in 2003. When he put his arm around me, he groped my right breast. He kept his hand all the way over on my breast. I've never had a man put their arm around me and then cup my breast. He was holding my breast on the side. I think that if more of these surface, I think Franken will face the same fate as John Conyers. Now, it does seem that Democrats are, you know, in terms of politicians, are being disproportionately affected here. But Joe Barton, a long-serving Republican from Texas, is going to, he has agreed not to run for another term in the House from his suburban Dallas district. This comes after news reports that Barton had carried on extramarital relationships with multiple women before a divorce in 2015. And yes, he sent a dick pic, which brought all this to light. And as a male, I can just tell you that there are absolutely no pics of my penis that I know of that are in circulation anywhere. And I have no idea why guys think that somehow that is sexy, attractive, or irresistible. It doesn't really work that way, dudes. Russell Simmons facing a new identified accuser, Jenny Lumet, the daughter of Sidney Lumet. She says that about 1991, Simmons offered her a ride back to her house. He locked the car doors, had his driver take them to his apartment, where he allegedly coerced her into sex. Simmons stepping down from Def Jam. Matt Lauer has issued a pretty detailed apology. Some of what is being said about me is untrue or mischaracterized, but there's enough truth in these stories to make me feel embarrassed and ashamed. I regret that my shame is now shared by the people I cherish dearly. There are no words to express my sorrow and regret for the pain I've caused others by words and actions. To the people I've hurt, I am truly sorry. He says that his new full-time job is trying to repair the damage that he has caused. Meanwhile, I'm confused about the Garrison Keillor story. Because, let's be true, be fair, Garrison Keillor is a skilled storyteller. But when it comes to what appears to be a single accusation, that in trying to comfort a woman he was friendly with and he was talking with, he put his hand on her back and whatever blouse or top she was wearing was open on her back. And so his hand made contact with her skin. And this appears to be the only allegation against him. Now, Keillor wrote, "I've been fired over a story that I think is more interesting and more complicated than the version that was heard by Minnesota Public Radio. Most stories are. It's some sort of poetic irony to be knocked off the air by a story, having told so many of them myself. But I'm 75, don't have any interest in arguing about this, and I can't in conscience bring danger to a great organization I've worked hard for since 1969. Now, after this contact, he says, my hand went up her back, the shirt was open. It went up about 6 inches. She recoiled. I apologized. I sent her an email of apology later. She replied that she had forgiven me, not to think about it. We were friends. We continued to be friendly right up until her lawyer called. Now, I'm sorry, this does not appear to be a sexual offense. It appears to be an issue of propriety, of decorum, of interpersonal relationships. And I don't understand, if this is the only case, why Garrison Keillor was fired and they're changing the name of Prairie Home Companion. I just find it quite extreme. So we'll see if more comes out in the wash there. Now to interesting news from the United States Senate. Doesn't have to do with the tax bill. And I rarely have praise for Dianne Feinstein, my senior senator from California. But it turns out for over 2 years, she has been writing Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, urging him not to go forward with the planned demolition of the West Bank Palestinian village of Susia. And it appears to have had the desired effect so far. And now she's been joined by 9 other Democratic senators, and I'm glad to see Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren among them. Because I've never really seen them directly confront the apartheid policies of the Israeli government. In addition to them, it's Pat Leahy of Vermont, Dick Durbin of Illinois, Tom Carper, Delaware, Al Franken, Minnesota, New Mexico's Martin Heinrich, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, and Hawaii's Brian Schatz. And I commend their effort. Now to the issues of privacy and surveillance. At The Intercept today, Trevor Aronson publishes a new piece. It's 30 pages long, and frankly, I've only gotten through about 10 so far. But it relates to the case of an Uzbeki who came to the United States in 2009. So far, I don't know that he became a U.S. citizen, but he was a U.S. person, which means that he was entitled to the protections of the Fourth Amendment, such as they are as it applies to government surveillance. And as he went to trial, and it appears he did have bad intentions regarding terrorism, it turns out that evidence was used against him from intercepted conversations with an associate in Pakistan. Now, the federal prosecutors claimed that the spying had been conducted under the FISA law. And Kurbanov, the man, was convicted at trial and sentenced to 25 years in prison. But now it is being argued that the intercepted conversations actually were grabbed via the PRISM program, which does not involve warrants. It's where the government just grabs information from eight large technology companies without a warrant. This was authorized by the FISA amendments of 2008. And it appears that in many cases, the government has failed to notify the defense attorneys about the source of the evidence being used. A nationwide review of federal court records found that of 75 terrorism defendants notified of some type of FISA spying, only 10 received notice that they were surveilled under Section 702. And yet the government brags that 702 has been used in over 100 arrests on terrorism-related offenses. All this arises as the Supreme Court is reviewing these issues, and Section 702 is up for revision or renewal by the end of this year. Yesterday, there were oral arguments at the Supreme Court in the Carpenter case. This is a guy who was convicted of robbery based on cell phone location data that was given up by a phone company. And the court heard arguments that people have an expectation of privacy about their phone records, even though the precedent doesn't support that. And the reason is that cell phones deliver much more information than our landline phone bills used to 30 years ago. And the lawyers from the ACLU representing Carpenter argued that the use of location data for 127 days should have required a warrant, because longer-term periods or aggregations of cell site information comprise a search and require a warrant. Justice Sotomayor seemed most sympathetic to these arguments. And I've linked to Trevor Timms' op-ed in The Guardian today, which ties together these two issues: the proposed renewal of 702 and the Supreme Court arguments. And Tim writes, if the Supreme Court rules the right way, it could protect the data emitted from our phones, often without our knowledge, and provide safeguards for police abuse. And if they don't, police may have carte blanche power to turn any American smartphone into a tracking device on demand. And Tim has minimum demands for reform of the FISA law. A, require the FBI to get a warrant before they go into the 702 database. And second, formally barring the blatantly unconstitutional practice known as ABOUT, where the U.S. indiscriminately sweeps up millions and millions of emails of anyone in the U.S. communicating with someone overseas, and then they search for certain search terms. Here in San Francisco, there is an angry federal judge whose name is Alsup. It is, I think it's William. Yeah, Judge William Alsup. And he is really pissed at Uber, because Uber is before his court in a case accused by Google's division Waymo of trying to steal self-driving car technology. And it's pretty clear that Uber hired a former Waymo technician and tried to bring over proprietary information from Waymo to Uber. Well, the trial has been suspended as Judge Alsup accuses Google of hiding information, of using nefarious ways of destroying internal communications so they couldn't be used as evidence in a trial like this. And now they're being asked to explain why they paid $4.5 million out to a former consultant who wrote a 37-page document that they received earlier this year, which had a lot of damaging information about the practices that Uber has been using. And I want to commend Carolyn Said. She is an ACE reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm going to link to her reports in the show file for today's podcast, and I hope you will check them out. It's a very interesting case. And finally today, we honor the work of actor-singer Jim Nabors, who's passed away at the age of 87. I remember him best as a crooner from the 50s, and he also was Gomer Pyle in the Andy Griffith Show and Mayberry RFD. And the interesting thing is, I did not know he was gay. I'm not surprised by it. But we learned from the obituary that his husband, Stan Cadwallader, confirmed his death. Thanks for joining me for my daily news and comment podcast. We give it away free, and we post it every day on YouTube to make it easier for people to grab it. I'm your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.